From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Good morning. This is a voice from Tibet, the country in the Himalayas, high on the roof of the world, where the 2,500-year-old tradition of Buddhism has stored away certain treasures of the human heart, now available to us on the planet today.
Today, an extended conversation with Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman on Buddhism in America and the politics of Tibet. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal district court judge in Washington threw out the tax evasion case against Webster Hubble, ruling in a powerful critique of the independent counsel's tactics that Kenneth Starr had been exceeded his authority and reneged on a promise to grant him immunity. The judge, James Robertson, found that the criminal case was too far removed from Starr's original mandate of 1994 to investigate the business dealings of President Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton in Arkansas more than a decade ago. The judge also ruled that prosecutors violated Hubble's right against self-incrimination by improperly using information obtained through an immunity agreement with Hubble to build the latest case against him. Judge Robertson called the original subpoena served on Hubble for that information, quote, a quintessential fishing expedition. Also this news, President Bill Clinton should put protection of civil and political rights high on his agenda when he meets Hong Kong leader Tung Chee Hwa today, this according to the New York-based Human Rights Watch Group. The main concern is planned national security legislation, which must be adopted under the Basic Law, which is the mini-constitution which came into force after Britain yielded the former colony to China on July 1, 1997. That legislation will prohibit acts of treason, secession, sedition, subversion, and theft of state secrets. The group said Hong Kong should distance itself from China's restrictive national security laws by narrowly defining threats to national security to exclude acts of nonviolent expression. And this, a follow-up on a story we did a few days ago. A Chinese prison official today dismissed allegations that prison labor was used to manufacture soccer balls in Shanghai for the Adidas sports label. An official of the Shanghai Prison Administration said no prisons or labor education camps in Shanghai produce any foreign brand footballs. The German sports equipment maker Adidas Salomon AG said yesterday it had stopped orders for soccer balls made in China while it investigated whether prison labor was used in their manufacture. The allegations were raised by exiled Chinese dissident Bao Ge. Bao Ge says he had sewn Adidas World Cup soccer balls while serving in the Shanghai First Labor Education Camp from 1994 to 1997. Adidas also said it had canceled all its current licensing contracts, effective the earliest legal termination date, and was reviewing all its ball suppliers from whom it buys up to 5 million balls a year. South Korean President Kim Dae-jung yesterday ordered the release of political prisoners even if they do not renounce their ideological views. Human rights groups estimate that there are about 500 political prisoners. The prisoners are to be released by August 15th, which is the 50th anniversary of the end of the Japanese occupation and of the founding of the Seoul government. According to local press reports, the man regarded as the world's longest-serving political prisoner, Woo Young-gak, will be among those to be freed in the amnesty. Woo has spent almost 40 years in solitary confinement, losing his teeth, suffering various illnesses, but refusing to renounce his commitment to North Korea. Other news of political prisoners, this from Nigeria. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said today Nigeria's military government had agreed to release all political prisoners amid expectations that opposition politician Masoud Abiola would soon be free. Annan told a news conference, "The government has agreed to release all political prisoners, and I believe the announcement will be made at the appropriate time." Abiola said he would want to be released to get on with his life. "He told me," said Kofi Annan, "I am not naive enough to think I can come out and be president." Four U.S. lawmakers on a visit to Chiapas yesterday urged a U.N. investigation into the situation in the strife-torn state and accused Mexico of hiding behind claims of foreign interference. Two Congress members and two members of the Illinois General Assembly, along with nine Methodist church members, made a three-day trip to the state. On the same day, Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo flew to Chiapas, where he made a speech defending the military buildup in the state. Members of the U.S. group traveled to the community of El Bosque, 430 miles southeast of Mexico City, where eight Zapatista supporters died in an army-backed police operation in June. And finally, expressing deep regret, the United States Holocaust Museum Tuesday accepted the resignation of John Roth, whose appointment as the head of the new Holocaust scholarship ran into severe criticism from some Jewish groups. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And here we are in the now 1 month of the General Motors strike. And I think the number of American workers now laid off is about 165,000 as the strike continues. And General Motors announced yesterday that its losses were now up to $1.2 billion.
You know, it's interesting, Juan. You did a column in today's New York Daily News about the labor movement being reborn and strong. And you talk about the GM strike. You also have been talking about the Puerto Rican telephone workers today in New York, local union 1199, which is part of now the Service Employees International Union, is holding a big protest in support of the telephone workers in Puerto Rico. Also yesterday, also in New York City, but very big news, 40,000 construction workers marched in the city.
Yeah, that was Tuesday, paralyzing down midtown Manhattan. Well, I think the point I make is that people were kind of shocked that these construction workers paralyzing midtown. The reality is that for the last year and a half, there's been an enormous upsurge in militancy in among American workers, beginning with the UPS strike, now through the General Motors strike. These construction workers, New York City alone has had 2 one-day work stoppages of taxi drivers who don't even have a union, in addition to a variety of other labor protests, about 20,000 hospital workers just a couple of weeks ago. So what you're seeing is a tremendous upsurge from American workers who keep hearing about this prosperity that the country is going through, but all they see is that their jobs continue to be downsized, contracting out, and reduction of health benefits. And one-third of the American workforce is now part-time workers. So, you know, as Jerry Nadler once said, the congressman from New York, he heard one of his constituents say, "Don't tell me about all those millions of jobs that Bill Clinton has created. I've got three of them myself." And that's the problem that we have in America today. This prosperity is bypassing a whole lot of people, and I think this resurgence of the labor movement is a response to that.
As we move into the 100th anniversary of the U.S. occupation of Puerto Rico, too, that the telephone company strike that has been going on, thousands of workers. We've talked about this before, but it's continuing.
Yes, and it's amazing to me. I was talking to my editors just a few days ago that our newspaper is not covering this strike. With all the emphasis and attention on the mass communications media and the importance of all these mergers and conglomerates in communications, the fact that on the island of Puerto Rico, which is still part of the United States, there is intense resistance to the idea of selling off a telephone company, that the people of Puerto Rico actually think that this telephone company, which ran very well, has produced profits for the government, should not be privatized, and are actually on strike only over that issue. Should the island of Puerto Rico's telephone company be sold to a private interest? And next week, a general strike once again has been called in the island, and no one's paying attention to it. No one's covering it in the United States.
Juan, talking about the telecommunications industry, you weren't with us last week for your usual Thursday and Friday co-hosting because you were in Miami at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists annual conference, and that was an issue, the telecommunications industry.
Yeah, well, the big discussion that was held there was the, you know, there have been a couple of recent decisions that are having a tremendous impact on the communications industry. One was the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia a couple of months ago basically threw out the FCC's affirmative action requirements for all broadcast television and radio stations, basically saying that it was a form of quotas or proportional representation. And that, of course, has has a lot of African-American, Latino, and Asian journalists fearing that the fact that the television industry has almost near parity in terms of its representation of minorities within the different fields in the industry is going to go backward. And also the American Society of Newspaper Editors recently began saying that they're going to pull back on their goal of reaching parity in the nation's newsrooms, to have the newsrooms of America reflect the population of America, because they had a goal for the year 2000 of reaching parity. They're not going to reach it, so now they're hoping to scale back the goals and give it another 10 years. So there's a lot of debate within the journalism profession right now over what's going to be happening to, and who's going to be covering the news over the next 10 or 15 years as we enter the new millennium.
Hmm. I know that the head of the Federal Communications Commission is African-American, and didn't President Clinton recently appoint a Latina woman to be one of the FCC commissioners?
Yes, Commissioner Christiani, who was on the panel that I moderated, as was the president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. But there's tremendous discontent in the newsrooms of this country over what's happening to media coverage in America. One of the things that I've raised, because next year there will be a second Unity gathering. You're going to have Unity. The first one was held 5 years ago in Atlanta. Was a gathering of 7,000 African American, Latino, Asian, and Native American journalists. I have consistently called it the largest gathering of journalists in the history of the United States. There's going to be a second Unity in Seattle next year, and one of the things that I've begun to propose to them is that the third world journalists in America take a lead in calling in the next 2 or 3 years a Congress of American journalists, white, black, Asian, Latino, everyone together, to sit down and discuss the incredible crisis that the journalism profession is facing in America today, from the corporate mergers to the race issue that has divided black and Latino and white journalists to the development of the new media, this whole question of what is a journalist today, when politicians like Susan Molinari and Pat Buchanan and others keep going back and forth from government and posing as journalists.
I think they should just be called FaceTime specialists. It doesn't really matter if you're a Congress member or you're a news anchor
on
CBS.
But I think that these ethical issues these questions of actually defining who is a journalist in this country needs to be thoroughly discussed, and that the third world journalists should take the lead in calling for a Congress of all journalists in the United States to discuss the state of the industry.
Well, another issue, Juan, that we haven't gotten a chance to discuss together that occurred while you were in Miami for the National Association of Hispanic Journalists is the federal civil rights case of Francis Lavoti, who is the officer who was charged in the beating death, or rather the chokehold death, of Anthony Baez in 1995 when it was around Christmas time and Anthony Baez had come up to visit his family in New York, and he was playing football on the property of his house in the Bronx that he had grown up with, his family, and his football hit a police car. Francis Lavoti came out of that police car, and as Anthony Baez's family describes it, as well as a few police officers, though not all that were there that night, when Anthony Baez objected to the fact that Francis Lavoti was arresting his younger brother for his football hitting the police car there because they like to take coffee breaks and sit by the Baez house because it was pretty quiet there. Francis Lavoti, by many accounts, put Anthony Baez in an illegal chokehold and he died. Well, though he was acquitted of the crime in this federal civil rights case, and this is very significant, he was found guilty by a jury. He now faces 10 years in prison. And one of the significant issues in this case was that two police officers came forward, one of them a woman, and we need more women police officers all over this country, Daisy Berea. And she told this amazing story. Actually, she wasn't able to tell this in the trial. The judge wouldn't allow it, but this is what she was going to say, was that other police officers had floated the idea after that fateful night, December 22nd, when Baez was killed, that a black man had run into the scene, put Anthony Baez in a chokehold, and run out. And this was being floated by other police officers to explain how he died of a chokehold without a cop having done it.
Yes, well, I'm very familiar with Daisy Buria because I wrote the first column when she testified initially in the state trial. And, of course, people have to understand the reason why Lavoti was acquitted in the state trial is he chose to have a non-jury trial before a judge, Scheindlin. And people forget that the judge, on the day he announced his verdict, said in the courtroom that the night before, when he came out of his Park Avenue apartment, all the tires of his car had been slashed. And, of course, that had no impact on his decision. And there was a lot of suspicion of who had slashed his tires. But then he declared Lavoti not guilty of the charge of murder. But in the civil rights case, I think it—
But he did say that—
There
that
was a nest of perjury among the police who had testified. And, of course, nothing has been done either by the police department or by the district attorney of the Bronx, Robert Johnson, and so far by Mary Jo White, the U.S. attorney in this case. We'll see if she follows through, because if you accept the testimony of Daisy Buria and the Baez family, and now you have a conviction of Lavoti, then the other cops were lying as to what actually happened and worked together as a group in the precinct to get their stories together. That's what's been come out in this trial.
And the jurors interviewed afterwards, a number of them said, because there were three police officers who said that Lavoti didn't engage in this illegal chokehold, the jurors simply said, and I think this is happening increasingly around the United States, we didn't believe the police officers. We simply didn't believe them.
And I've got to tell you, I've covered so many of these cases right now, and I've seen what happens in official reports of police departments, not just here but in other cities, that I think that as journalists and then the general public by extension has got to be very, very skeptical and critical of official versions of either confessions, accounts that occur that are put forth by police departments until police departments demonstrate that they are going to punish cops who lie, who fabricate evidence, who conspire to change testimonies, then the public has to take the viewpoint we're going to be very skeptical of official versions of what happens in crimes across the country.
And last news point, sort of wrap-up of the week. People may remember just a few days ago, regular Democracy Now! Listeners, that we had Bao Ge in our studios. Bao Ge, the Chinese dissident, who says that he was making Adidas soccer balls for the World Cup in a Shanghai prison labor camp. And he was here in our New York studio, his translator in Washington, as he described making those soccer balls. And today we see the Chinese government is denying that soccer balls are made in prison labor camps and Adidas, and this is quite typical for multinational corporations until really pushed, said they are going to end their contracts with China for all such balls, football, soccer balls, but saying that they didn't know about it. Often you see when these companies are really pushed, and we see it more and more, they are being held accountable, that they know who their subcontractors are. They know why they're getting such incredibly cheap deals. But that leads us into what we're going to talk about today. President Clinton continuing his trip in China and then moving on to Hong Kong. Well, a bomb exploded in Tibet's capital on the eve of President Clinton's visit to China, blowing out windows and buildings near the police headquarters. Unconfirmed reports put the number of injured at 3 or 4. The bombing was the first in the Chinese-ruled Himalayan region in 18 months and may signal renewed attacks by Tibetans despite appeals for nonviolence by the Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled leader. Clinton had promised to press Chinese leaders on Tibet, and in discussions on Saturday with President Jiang Zemin, urged China to reopen negotiations with the Dalai Lama. Jiang told reporters the Dalai Lama must first recognize Beijing as Tibet's sovereign. The Dalai Lama has condemned violent tactics to protest Chinese rule and has said he seeks autonomy for Tibet, not independence. Chinese soldiers seized Tibet in 1950, the year after the communists took power in China. After an attempted uprising in 1959, the Dalai Lama led more than 100,000 Tibetans into exile. As soon as stations identify themselves in our minute break, we're going to come back with a special guest for the rest of this hour. He is Robert Thurman, and he is the leading Tibetan Buddhist American scholar in this country. He's going to talk about the Dalai Lama, the politics of Tibet, and Buddhism in America. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And we couldn't talk about President Clinton's trip to China without talking about the issue of Tibet, one that is a big issue here as well in the United States because of the many supporters of Tibet and the Dalai Lama. We're joined right now by Robert Thurman. He is a college professor at Columbia University. He is the co-founder and president of Tibet House, which is a cultural nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving the endangered civilization of Tibet. And he is the first American Tibetan Buddhist monk. He's written a number of books, lectures all over the world, and joins us now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you, Amy and Juan. It's nice to be here with you.
Well, let's start off with the president's trip and what you think of its significance for Tibet.
Well, it's quite significant for Tibet, Amy. It was we were very worried about it up to the last minute because the Chinese refused the credentials of a special envoy for Tibet that the Congress forced the State Department to appoint about 6 months ago, a man named Greg Craig, who works closely with Madeleine Albright. And Ben Gilman and Jesse Helms and others on the Senate Foreign Relations and House Foreign Relations Committee forced the State Department to appoint him to coordinate Tibetan affairs and try to get a negotiation between the Dalai Lama's government in exile and the Chinese oligarchy, try to get that negotiation going. And the Chinese refused to allow the Clinton entourage, consisting of hundreds of people, maybe 1,000 people, to bring this guy because they're claiming that we have no right to discuss this issue of Tibet. And the Clinton people conceded to that. First, they tried to rename the guy and say, oh, well, he's not really Tibet. He's coming there as Madeleine Albright's assistant. And then when the Chinese still refused his credentials, instead of balking and saying, look, you know, we're coming with our people and, like, take it or leave it, they backed down, Clinton people. So we thought they would be completely ignoring Tibet. So first of all, they got that unexpected TV, press conference. And then second, Clinton did bring up Tibet. And he made the personal plea to Jiang Zemin that you should talk to this guy. I trust the Dalai Lama. I've met the Dalai Lama. That was very courageous in a sort of social sense of Clinton, an unusual piece of direct face-to-face bravery instead of appeasement. And we were very pleased about it and had a very profound effect, I think. It will have a very profound effect because Jiang Zemin will be forced to sort of reconsider their party line, which is that, you know, he said when he was here, Lincoln freeing the slaves and all this fake propaganda about how the Tibetans were feudal slave owners and all this and they liberated them, and the fake propaganda about how the fact that they own Tibet, that Tibet has always been part of China, which is another huge lie, and or that there's free speech in Tibet, or that the Tibetans are happy, or that Tibet is prospering. All of these huge lies he did repeat, but nevertheless, he'll be forced to re-examine that a little bit now, and he'll be forced to consider whether or not it's more beneficial for him to talk with the Tibetans and the Dalai Lama rather than continuing to try to stonewall the issue, which is what they've been doing. And American corporations, of course, have absolutely coddled them in doing that, just as the British before them coddled the Chinese in the pretense of owning Tibet for 100 years, actually. This old game is not a new game of sort of modern multinationals. It's been going on ever since the British have been making money in Hong Kong. Through three Chinese governments, they've been playing this game. And that led to Mao Zedong making the largest land grab and territorial annexation since World War II, which was the annexation of Tibet's 900,000 square mile territory.
For those of our listeners who don't know that history, what has been the history back in time between the relations between Tibet and China?
Right. Well, Juan, Tibet was an ancient conquest dynasty in Central Asia, sort of like Genghis Khan, but about 400 or 500 years earlier than him. In the 7th and 8th century, they conquered and toppled, actually, the Tang Dynasty for a while, and the Tang Dynasty Chinese had to pay tribute to keep them up in the mountains because they were really rough and tough kind of wild men, you know, the Tibetans. And they conquered the Silk Route for about 2 centuries in that time, 7th, 8th, 9th century, and they conquered into Nepal. They were very ferocious. But once they encountered two things, once they had completely unified the whole plateau, which is this 3-mile-high plateau, this unique environment that really no one else can live in, they lost the appetite to conquer further outside in the lowland areas because they didn't want to settle there, you know, because they like to live at high altitude. So Then they encountered in all those areas Buddhism as the sort of matrix of these more cultivated, more refined civilizations in India and China and in Central Asia. And once they did that, they began to import Buddhism. Once they imported Buddhism, they became more peaceful and less interested in conquest. And in fact, after 1,000 years, they became completely demilitarized and totally vulnerable. Their manpower going into monkhood, monasticism, rather than into militarism. So they are culturally totally different from the Chinese. Neither they nor a Chinese person identify with each other racially or culturally or linguistically. No Tibetan ever heard of Confucius. They don't know who he is. He has no meaning for them. And the Chinese similarly have no meaning. They don't know who are the great cultural heroes of Tibet. I mean, they're really different countries, you know. And they're like the Lakota Indians and the white people from England. I mean, it's that different. And the Mongolians, when they had an empire which included China, and the Manchurians, when they had an empire which included China, they had a kind of military protectorate over Tibet, which by that time had become monastic and Buddhist and peaceful. But they never incorporated Tibet in any kind of administration that made it sort of one entity with China. And there was no Chinese population in Tibet whatsoever until 1950, except for a few occasional traders or officials, but no permanent residents at all in Tibet. Because basically they don't like, you know, the Chinese are this one interesting set of the big urban civilizations. They're the only one who built a big wall like that, walling off the river valleys from the highlands. And they never had herding animals in their sort of national culture. They didn't drink milk in their national diet. They simply were not into nomadism and pastoralism, which is what the Tibetans and the Mongolians lived on. So the Chinese, in fact, and the Tibetans are just totally different is the main point. And in 1950, Mao went in there because he wanted to take Taiwan, he wanted to take Korea, and he wanted to take Tibet to sort of expand the quote-unquote motherland. And that was the first time any Chinese regime had ever gone in conquest in Tibet. And he did take it very quickly because Nehru wouldn't speak up in the UN, because Nehru had this idea that him and Mao were going to be the two big Asian giants who were going to like deal with the colonialists and all this. And he never dreamed that his fellow Mao would become a colonialist himself, you know. Or, of course, he never dreamed that he himself would go into Goa and Sikkim and actually be a little bit colonialistic on his own right. He didn't really realize that that's how the system co-opts you, you know, which is basically what happened to Mao. And so the true story is that Tibet is a sovereign country, independent for thousands of years, written history from before England even had writing. And the Chinese have taken it over since the World War II, post-World War II UN system. And the Chinese know that. That's why the Chinese basically try to stonewall the issue and refuse to discuss it. It would be as if Saddam Hussein and gone in, taken over Kuwait, gotten away with it, and then said, well, it's always been part of Iraq and we don't want to talk about it. It's sort of been like that.
You know, I've been interested in the whole issue of what it is that the Dalai Lama supports right now, surprised by the fact that now the papers are saying for quite a time that he has supported Tibetan autonomy under Chinese rule.
Since 1988, actually.
I mean, I'm always skeptical of trying to understand what someone thinks, because on the issue of Timor, some are trying to say now that they support autonomy under Indonesia, which don't do. They support it for a transitional time, but demand their independence.
No, José is very clear. José Ramos Horta is very, very clear about that. Well, what the story is with the Dalai Lama is the following. And when Jiang Zemin says that he'll talk to Dalai Lama as long as Dalai Lama pledges to be part of China, there's a very complicated thing there, because what the Dalai Lama has said, and which he can't help but say, is that I can't say that Tibet has always been part of China. That's impossible, because it hasn't. I can't lie, in other words. And Tibet was not part of China until 1959, really, when China nakedly took over. Even in 1951, the Chinese claimed they were just going in to get rid of some imperialists and help out the Tibetans be free within Tibet's own terms. So what the Dalai Lama says is that Tibet actually has not been part of China and was a sovereign country for thousands of years. However, the way things are now, because of the de facto reality, we would consider very strongly, and I would use all my influence as the Dalai Lama and as the moral and really legitimate leader of the Tibetan people, who all the Tibetan people look to as their leader, and I would try to persuade them to vote in a self-determining plebiscite to join the Chinese Union. If the Chinese would say, you can really be autonomous, we will withdraw our occupation armies, we will withdraw our prison camp system, we will withdraw our colonists who are taking away your land and your minerals and your forests, and, you know, we'll do deals with them like the British did in Zimbabwe after they dropped the pretense of owning Rhodesia, you know, as Commonwealths do, you know. So the trick is the Dalai Lama can't say we've always been part of China. Because it's not true.
I mean, Rhodesia became Zimbabwe and became independent.
Exactly. But then the British still bought the chromium. You know, then in other words, the British interest still happens in Zimbabwe, you know. Once you go to Commonwealth, often the previously colonial power becomes economically very strongly, sometimes more strongly involved. That's the game of the Commonwealth after the empire. Do you know what I mean? China is still basically doing the empire and trying to like fill up Tibet with Chinese, which has been very difficult for China because Tibet is 3 miles high, which is a little hard if you've always lived at sea level to live in a 3 mile high climate. Trust me, you know, it's very, very difficult. And Chinese women have to go down and have their babies in a low altitude below 8,000 feet to Chengdu or to Xining or one of the areas on the lowland. It's dangerous for them to have their babies even in the high things, so they're never going to be able to colonize long term, you know, Tibet, which is what has saved Tibet otherwise. Mao had said when he went in 1950 that by 1960 he would have 60 million Chinese in Tibet, which he was not able to do because it's too expensive and that they don't like the climate and there's no subsistence livelihood for them in Tibet except extraction, sort of, you know, colonial extraction industries. But it just won't work for them to do it. And each new Chinese administration, like Deng, tried it. Now Li Peng and Jiang are trying. They're trying to see if they can finish off the Tibetans by sort of colonizing the country and just getting rid of the Tibetans. But it never has worked so far, you know, and it won't work really. And they'll just make a mess of the place.
So, in essence, what you're saying and what you have indicated or suggested in a piece, an op piece in the Wall Street Journal,
right,
is the one country, two systems approach that has been used in Hong Kong.
And they could offer to Taiwan if the Taiwanese would ever believe it, which they won't believe it, the way the Chinese have behaved up to now, is offer that system where the Dalai Lama will say, well, look, we weren't part of China before, but now de facto we've been part of China for 50 years. The way the world system works, maybe it's to our advantage to be part of China if China stops oppressing us and genociding us. Therefore, we will vote to be part of China. And, you know, that gives the Chinese a way out of this false claim they've been making for 50 years. They can then say, well, okay, the Tibetans have decided to join. But then to get the Tibetans to do that and to give them that legitimacy, they're going to have to give Tibet back true internal autonomy. But that would be, my argument is, that is very much to the Chinese advantage, because right, then their biggest problem internationally, of course, is the problem of Taiwan, which is one of the richest countries in Asia. And really, China needs the expertise of the people in Taiwan. They need the capital of Taiwan. They need them. And they don't want to have to fight them. And the West would have to defend Taiwan, even though we pretend we don't care and it's one country. And that could be solved by the Chinese showing they understand what is a federal system, what is a commonwealth, how to play the game in modern terms. And therefore, they should take this opportunity they have in Tibet, is my view.
We're talking to Robert Thurman, who's the first Western Tibetan Buddhist monk. He shares a 35-year friendship with the Dalai Lama.
Right.
How did you come to know him? How'd you meet him?
Well, Amy, when I was a kid in college, I got sort of sick of Western civilization and dropped out.
I know
out.
The feeling.
So-called, or actually, you know, Western civilization. Once Gandhi was, somebody said, what about American civilization, Mr. Gandhi? And he said, American civilization? Well, that would be a good idea, he said. Which I like that idea myself, I have to say. Anyway, I was sick of the pretense of American civilization. I was brought up in WASPomania, you know. I went to all these WASP schools, although I was on scholarships. But I just felt it was headed down a trail to doom, personally, in my youth. And finally, first I actually went to join Castro in 1958 out of high school, which I failed to do, which is why I'm still alive.
Wait a minute. You went to join Fidel Castro?
I did, actually. Yes. I ran away from Exeter and went to join Castro. Went to
Exeter
Miami.
Exeter Academy?
Yep. I went to Miami with a Mexican friend of mine, and we went to some bar under pseudonyms. We had a pistol, the whole thing. We tried to join. You know, Castro was at that time still in the Sierra Maestra, and luckily they refused our conscription, you know, our volunteering, because they thought we would just get killed in 2 seconds, which I'm sure was true. And that didn't work. So then I went back a little bit into the system. And then eventually I sort of freaked out and went off internally and went to India. And in, a couple of years later, when I was 19 or 20, I went to India. And then in India, I met the Tibetans, and then I began to sort of discover a civilization, the Indo-Tibetan Buddhist civilization, where you learn to control your mind and your greed and your hatred and your false notions of identity and racism and sexism and what have you. And I learned to begin to work on all those things, which I inherited in ample abundance from my redneck forebears. And I've been working on that ever since, and enchanted and delighted with discovering the Indo-Tibetan civilization and the Buddhist psychology, really, in philosophy. I never was much of a religious fanatic. I only became a monk at that time because that was the way of getting a scholarship in Tibet, was you get to be a monk, and then they let you study, and they bring you free lunch, and you can study forever for at the price of shaving your head and wearing a red robe, you know. And but I couldn't stay a monk when I came back to America because there's no free lunch in America, you know, in the Protestant America. So I went back to school, you know, and became a professor, you know. But that's sort of my story in a nutshell. It's in the book there.
And how did you meet the Dalai Lama?
Well, I met him there. He just escaped from the Chinese in 59. He stayed and tried to work with Mao from 51 when they invaded 50, when they invaded 259. Because he thought, you know, the Marxist idealistic attitude, you know, and they were for the people and, you know, sharing and the communal kind of. He thought it was good, nice idea. It would fit with Buddhist ideals. And he thought that Mao would help him reform things he wanted to reform in Tibet, and he was trying to work with them. But then he realized that, you know, although the communists had this rhetoric of liberation and things like that, really there was this Chinese colonial thing of them wanting to be a big empire like, you know, they perceived the British having been, and they perceived the Manchus as having been, and they perceived the Russians as being. And there was no way in which they were doing any idealistic thing. They were actually enslaving the whole of Tibet, as they in a way enslaved all of their own people in this dictatorship that eventually emerged, you know. And so it just was unrealistic, he finally realized. And then it came a point when they were about to either kill him or capture him in 1959. The general who was running the Tibet occupation was either going to kill or capture the Dalai Lama. And when the Dalai Lama knew that once he did that, the Tibetans, who are very brave people, and they are a race of conquerors like Genghis Khan in the past, they've turned that powerful courage into self-conquest and into a certain kind of amazing high culture over many centuries. But if they were really despaired and really freaked, they would go. They're no wimps, you know. They would go crazy, and they would get killed. Therefore, because the Chinese are so much more numerous than they are, so he fled the country so the Chinese couldn't capture him, so he could speak the truth about the Tibetan situation to the world. But he was muzzled in India from 59. Although the Indians were very kind to him internally, they let them have a refugee community there and a government in exile. They wouldn't let them speak externally, and he couldn't get visas to go abroad. He was muzzled. After Kissinger and Nixon went to Beijing, he couldn't get a visa to the United States for 10 years. And the truth of Tibet was really kept suppressed until it finally began to emerge in the 80s after Jimmy Carter, actually Cyrus Vance, let the Dalai Lama come to America. And then he began to tell his story, and people heard it, and people have begun to love it.
We're talking to Robert Thurman, Indo-Tibetan studies professor at Columbia University, author of a number of books on Tibet, the first American Tibetan Buddhist monk. His latest book is called Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. But we'll be back with Robert Thurman after this break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and the music we're using during our break is from, boy, this is an artifact, it's a record, and it's called Heart Dance River Flow Folk Music of Tibet. Beautiful flute music. Our guest for this hour is Robert Thurman. His book is called Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness. Again, the first American Tibetan Buddhist monk, but I should be saying ex-monk, because as evidenced by Uma, his daughter, Uma Thurman, and his four other children and his three grandchildren. But he has long had a relationship with the Dalai Lama, championed the cause of Tibet in this country, is a professor of Indo-Tibetan studies, the first endowed chair in the subject at Columbia University. I want to ask, though, about Tibet and what it was. You champion a kind of Tibetan democracy everywhere, but there are those who say that there wasn't democracy in Tibet under the Dalai Lama and the monks, that it was a kind of feudal system.
Right. It wasn't a democracy, Amy, in the sense that there was no ballot box. But the Dalai Lama is the first to agree to that, and he's been trying to – he has instituted in the refugee community a democracy and elections and a parliament and everything. They did have an assembly and a parliament, but things were not – people were not elected. They were appointed according to a certain system. However, feudal is an incorrect thing. That is a Chinese propaganda term, and certain Western anthropologists who suck up to the Chinese to get visas and suck up to our State Department to get visas and be promoted as Tibet specialists and big shots will say feudal, but it is actually totally – even the Dalai Lama will say feudal because he likes to bracket the question, because nobody in the case of a genocide or a Holocaust goes and says, well, what was the social structure of the people who got killed? Were they perfect modern Democrats carrying their liberal liberation card and their social security numbers, or were they did they have elements of so-called quote-unquote pre-modern system about them, or what were they? People don't ask that. When they're being killed, first thing is to stop the killing and to get them back their self-determination. So the Dalai Lama even will use the term in order to bracket it. However, I'm scolding him about using it, and I think I've almost persuaded him that it is an inaccurate term, because I've studied the social system, and it lacks certain things about a feudal system. First thing it lacks is that there was no military in Tibet for the last 300 years. It had a feudal system until the 17th century, as everywhere else in the world did, and there was no ballot boxes. But after the 17th century, although they didn't go into the ballot box direction, and they didn't go into the Industrial Revolution type of direction, they went in a different direction, but they did abolish the feudal system in the sense that they abolished militarism. And Tibet basically was demilitarized and had to actually call for help from one neighbor when any other neighbor would bother them, you know, militarily with an incursion on the frontier, because they had no army, basically. Feudal system means having feuds all the time, and your peasant belongs to the lord of a region because he's basically an infantryman in that lord's army, and therefore the lord has the power of life and death over that peasant, which you can call a serf in the feudal system. The German word is Leibeigener, which means life owner. And Tibet had no such system. It was abolished in the 17th century because the lords had no power to make war on anybody. They were demilitarized. And they then developed this very unique form of government where monasteries, they expropriated the aristocracy and their armies, and monasteries then took over with the aristocrats, and they sort of worked as officials in different layers of the government, which had a kind of very organized bureaucracy. The second thing that completely refutes the feudal thing is, after that point, 85% of the land of Tibet was given written title, primary title holder being the peasants who farmed that land. And they had, of course, a tax obligation of from 6% to 13%. And their written title was kept in both Lhasa and in the regional provincial headquarters, you know, administrative headquarters, and they had to pay a tax. There would be secondary title holders, which could either be a monastery, could be an aristocratic family, or most often was the central government, and that tax money was 6 to 15% of the yield of the land that they farmed. But they had a written title to the land, which no serf in any feudal system has ever had a written title. And no one had power of life and death over that peasant either, which they should be properly called as peasants. And what were the taxes spent on? They were not spent on any military expenditure. There was no prison system to speak of in Tibet. There was a central prison for political traitors or something in the capital, but basically no sort of penitentiaries. They didn't have a million people in prison like we do in the United States, for example, in our vaunted democracy. And then they had one other remarkable institution, Amy, which functioned a little bit like what the dream of democracy would function like if it really worked. And that is that because of the belief in reincarnation, their leadership kept coming back, life after life. So you didn't have to have some new turkey like Ronald Reagan or some jerk who you would elect who would turn into an oppressor of the people. If Thomas Jefferson ever had been a good president, he would keep being reborn, and he would just prove to you by going to the psychics and the oracles and the visions of the people that he was the reincarnation of Thomas Jefferson, and you would constantly give the mandate to whoever was this sort of on-the-job training over many lifetimes. Now, that's the Tibetan belief system. Of course, Westerners don't believe in reincarnation. I know that. A few do, actually, nowadays, but most don't. But the point is, in the Tibetan system, the way this worked was, for example, the Dalai Lamas in the last 300 years, all but one of the Dalai Lamas was born in a peasant family, either nomadic or farming peasant family. So that's a way of like log cabin to White House sort of thing, you see what I mean? But not by voting, because they didn't have that system, but by the fact that the leader themselves, in the Tibetan view, would take rebirth in a humble family. And as I say, only one out of the 14 Dalai Lamas that has been there was born in a high aristocratic family.
What then happened to the non-believers, those who, for one reason or another, did not believe in Buddhism?
Well, see, this is a key thing. You see, Buddhism doesn't require belief, you see. Buddhism is not a religion that promotes a worldview that the ultimate reality is something you can't understand, and therefore you have to adopt a belief which is against your common sense. You know the famous definition of belief of the little boy in the congregation in Ohio? Johnny, do you know what faith is? And the pastor says, he says, sure I do, pastor. That is believing in what you know ain't true. So the point is, Buddhism doesn't require that sort of belief, right. You see. Therefore, it's not really just a religion. It's a system of education and a way of life, you see. And most of the Tibetans, they shared a common worldview, which is that, you know, you're a product of evolution, and you can use your human life to take charge of that evolution so as to evolve to a higher form of higher consciousness where you won't be in danger of being reborn in any painful or unpleasant situation, and you then can expand your life until you become an enlightened being where you're sort of you become a giant sea of bliss or something extravagant like that. And they basically had that kind of idea, and they lived oriented towards using their life in that way, you see. They didn't really believe God created the world or there was some power. Therefore, for example, theocracy is totally inappropriate for Tibet, although lamas and monks were given the responsibility by the Tibetan people to run their lives, to run their countries, because they thought that they would be better than some warlord who had been running it before that for thousands of years and who was having an army and making them soldiers, you see. So they thought some monk who didn't have relatives and wasn't into making war would be a better person to rule them. But that monk was not identified with an omnipotent god, you see, which is where theocracy comes from. The idea that your life is controlled by some outside force, and therefore this person represents that authority and can have absolute authority over your life. The Dalai Lamas were the reincarnations of what they call bodhisattvas, who are angels in their view, who are there to serve human beings. You know, they're like your servant. They're supposed to be there like mothers, like compassion, to do whatever you need, you see, and therefore not boss you, but actually serve you, you see. So they didn't really have, you know, Tibetans are completely fearless, individualistic people. They have a famous saying, where there's 20 Tibetans, there are 40 horns. Do you know what I mean? Like a yak, you know? And yaks among the cows are the least domesticated of the cows. They're semi-tame only, always. And Tibetans are like that. So they're not groveling. And, I mean, they can grovel just for the hell of it. They can act like they're very, very subservient. But then they'll go around and do what they want, whether the Dalai Lama told them this or told them that. As many Dalai Lamas have discovered, they don't necessarily obey their leaders. They're very individualistic. So this is why the state of Tibetan society before, it had its faults, but it was actually something very unique that we don't have terms for in our modern Protestant, historical, progressivist, triumph of industry type of ideology that we have in the West, you know, materialistic ideology. We simply don't have terms for it. It was not a feudal system. It was nothing. They didn't want to be liberated by no Chinese from nothing, the Tibetans, and they still don't want to. They want to be free. But the Dalai Lama, just out of pragmatism, is offering to join China. If the Chinese would behave themselves and give them autonomy.
Professor Thurman, speaking of materialism, what is the Dalai Lama doing on Apple ads that say think different?
Oh, bad management, Amy. That's just bad management. Somebody came to him and said, gee, we're going to have this sort of genius thing, and it's not really advertising, it's just some sort of innovative, creative thing. Some very clever PR person sold the line to some Tibet officials of that. And then the Tibetans are always thinking, of course, you see that the way they view the Dalai Lama is this like angel, you see. So the more people who physically see the Dalai Lama, the better it is for their lives, the more cheerful their lives will be. They have that kind of attitude. So they can justify things. And well, gee, this picture will be everywhere. Won't that be nice? And he didn't get any money for it. And he didn't really realize it was advertising Apple computers. And, you know, and therefore, you know, he didn't do that. So well, they got three computers were given to some school in India, you know, like 15,000. It was a real cheap deal for Apple. And he just let them have it. He let them have the image for that without really understanding that this was playing into commercialism and corporate capitalism. Didn't really realize that. And
I also recently saw a full page ad, I think it was in the New York Times, of the Dalai Lama and one of the evangelists, the right-wing evangelists. What was it?
I heard about that myself only 2 days ago, and I didn't see it.
Saying that we
Washington.
Promote trade with China.
I know.
It's very confusing considering when Jiang Zemin came to the United States and you had the big state dinner with Clinton.
Right.
You had this alternatives kind of dinner across the street. You had massive protests.
Right. Richard Gere.
Richard Gere was there and others,
right?
Saying that this should not be happening. I mean, clearly both the China trip in China as well as Jiang Zemin's trip to the United States had a lot to do with cementing corporate deals.
Of course, trying to sell them nuclear stuff.
And yet you have the Dalai Lama in these ads saying trade with China.
I know. Well, Dalai Lama does take the view. His policy could be characterized as an appeasement policy, and there are Tibetans who do characterize the government in exile's policy nowadays as an appeasement policy. Since the Dalai Lama genuinely said, which the Chinese pretend he never did say, that he would join the Chinese Union, he would ask his people. He never said he would join, and therefore the people would automatically do it. But he said he would use his you know charisma, authority, persuasive power with his people to get them to vote to join, you know, do their self-determination by joining China. Ever since then, some Tibetans have rejected him as doing appeasement. So Dalai Lama has always supported the idea that prosperity in China will help force the Chinese leaders to become more democratic within China and less imperialistic outside of China. Therefore, it would be good for Tibet. Just like he's never supported an intifada, you know, or an Afghan type of jihad against them because Buddhism doesn't support that, you know, a violent, you know, stinger missile type of approach to the Chinese. He's never supported that. So some of his own people who would like to go back to the days of the conquest dynasty of Tibet, the great empire, they reject him as being too appeasement-oriented. However, this particular ad you're talking about was an embarrassment to most of us in the Tibet movement, and how it happened is the following. When the people in the Congress wanted to protest the mistreatment of Christians in China, and you know, the sort of right-wing types, and the Tibetans thought, well, we better join on this legislation to punish countries that do religious persecution, because they are persecuting us religiously. And so then those people used the Dalai Lama's image, you know, a little bit, and this was carelessly that they were allowed to use that.
Who was the evangelist?
His image because we were joining with them in the sense of sharing the protest against religious persecution. We were not quite going for trade the same way they're going for trade, although the Dalai Lama does want China to prosper. He thinks that prosperity in China will help them develop a generation of leaders who will be more responsive. But on the other hand, he doesn't have the naive view that commerce alone will do it. In fact, the Tibetans have been warning the Western powers for a long time that if you allow China to develop nuclear arms, you know, industrial power, the ability to construct any kind of military equipment, buy all the military equipment from Russia, including weapons of mass destruction, and you let this happen to basically what is still a rogue nation, never mind they have a seat in the UN, and never mind they exercise Security Council veto power, and never mind the United States has betrayed Taiwan. Even though Taiwan was a bunch of rightist fanatics themselves, they still were our ally through World War II, and we just totally betrayed them to curry favor and try to get trade, you know, with China based on American businesses' naive fantasy that a billion shoelaces, you know, that they're going to sell a billion shoelaces to a billion Chinese. Then most of them don't wear shoes, and once they do, they'll make their own shoelaces and bankrupt our shoelace industry. So it's a stupid idea of American business that you can do just trade and not some human rights pressure, not some moral sort of something. But you know that, Amy. Yeah. This is WBAI. America has sold out to the dictatorships of the world in order to get cheap labor to destroy America's own labor force. You know that is what is going on, and it's against the interests of the American people. But it's our lack of democracy here that makes our leaders support their lack of democracy there, and the Dalai Lama knows that too. But he may be a bit naive about it, but he knows something about it. But the point is, he is just trying to get China to the point where the Chinese people themselves will finally protest, and they will finally demand a kind of
democracy internally and lack of imperialism externally, which goes together, you know?
Let me ask you a little about Buddhism in the little time that we've got
tiny
left.
Tiny bit to Buddhism. 2 minutes of Buddhism. I'm used to doing it 2 minutes, Juan. Go ahead.
Well, the of all the great religions of the world,
yes.
it seems to have fared it had the most difficult time with the development of modernization and the expansion of capitalism. Even Islam, for instance, seems to have grown in the situation of advanced capitalism. Why do you think that is, and why has it had such little following even in the United States? For instance, Islam has grown in many of the black and Latino communities of America, whereas Buddhism seems to have grown where it has in the United States, largely among middle or upper-income Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the reason for that is, Juan, that Buddhism isn't just a religion, you see. Mm-hmm. Buddhism is a kind of movement, spiritual and educational movement, trying to help people become self-reliant. And basically, people have to have developed already a certain type level of outlet for materialism. In other words, a certain level of like wealth and affluence. Buddhism grew in the most affluent of the ancient Eurasian countries, which was India in the ancient time. You know, the riches of India, you know what I mean, was a big thing.
Right.
It attracted the Europeans to conquer it. And once they do that, they know that affluence by itself, it doesn't, you know, it just leads to Prozac, you know, or alcoholism, you know, or divorce or whatever, you know, serial divorce. And then you want to explore your mind and how to control your inner emotions and how to develop an inner aesthetic. And that's what Buddhism appeals to, you see. And so Buddhism, as you say, in this century, industrial capitalism and modernity has wiped out Buddhism. But it could be, Juan, that in the short term it's seen itself destroyed as an institution, like in the old Taoist thing. It's like the grass bending with the hurricane.
Right.
See, the monotheistic religions teach power, and they teach just have a belief and that will save you, belong to this or that group, and then conquer this or that. You know what I mean? They sort of fit very well with the authoritarian mindset that industrial capitalism is based on. And so it's not too hard to switch back and forth between one or the other. You just align yourself with a new big power, then you go out and fight. Mm-hmm. Buddhism is into not fighting, you know, not it's conquering yourself instead. It brings out the power of the feminine, of wisdom, and therefore it hasn't been popular for the last 2,000 or 3,000 years as far as state movements. It's always been an antidote to the state. Monasticism was invented by Buddhism, which is an antidote to militarism, as my book Inner Revolution does testify to. And so for these reasons, Buddhism takes a little thinking to get into. Mm-hmm. And we don't want it to be popular. We don't want to compete with Islam and Christianity. We want Muslims and Christians themselves to use the educational methods of Buddhism to be more moderate Muslims and Christians, or materialists to be more moderate materialists. Amy, let me just say one last thing. I'll be really
you
in
have
trouble.
10 seconds.
10 seconds. World Tibet Day is on July 5th. It's a big meeting at 106th Street in Central Park West.
That's here in New York. And let me say also,
worldwide, too.
All over the country, there are going to be events because Monday is the Dalai Lama's birthday. We've been speaking with Robert Thurman. His latest book, Inner Revolution, published by Riverhead Books. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hsu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and a great thank you to Robert Thurman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Thank you.